to another episode of Your Life Beyond You podcast, where we are challenging you to intentionally invest into the lives of others. I am your host, Terrence Campbell, and I am so thankful that you took the time to listen to today's podcast. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite listening platforms. Hey, did you know that April is Autism Awareness Month? Well, today we have an awesome couple that will share their life experience with us. They will provide us with information on how to recognize the warning signs and the value of early intervention. Well, it is my pleasure and privilege today to welcome to the podcast Mike and Marsha Crutchfield.
Hello, what's going on,
people? Hey, how's it going?
Going well, y'all. So glad to have you all on the podcast. So excited to have you all with us here today.
We're glad to be here. Appreciate the opportunity. Humbled to be a part of this. And we're just excited to share.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Thank you all so much. So, Mike and Marsha, I'd like for you all just to kind of introduce yourselves to our listeners. Give us some fun facts and information about how y'all met and a little about your family.
So we have been married for 18 years this year. In July, it's going to be 19 years. And we met in Little Waco, Texas. This is before, you know, it started to expand and, you know, Chip and Joanna started their business and Baylor, you know, started to flourish. But so back in the day, I was attending grad school, and I was working. And my supervisor kept telling me, you got to meet this guy. You have to meet this guy. She was best friends with, at that time, Michael's sister. And so she, knew Mike very well, knew the family very well, and was just saying, oh my gosh, I just think you guys are going to be a perfect match. So it just so happened one night when we got off of work, I went over to her house and Mike happened to be there. And so that was my first time, you know, getting a chance to meet him. And we always laugh about this.
It wasn't official meeting. It was like indirect. She was getting her hair braided.
I was, yeah. I was getting my hair braided. So he was going to definitely see the nappy side of life for me. But what was interesting is that even though it was our first encounter, he was working super hard to try to impress me. So he was, you know, trying to be center of attention and make jokes and, you know, trying to make me laugh and kind of get me engaged and whatnot. And so, I thought it was cute. It was funny. And then he eventually asked me out. I don't know if you want to chime in on that part, babe, but he eventually asked me out on a date, and long story short, it didn't really go too well for me.
According to her.
He just talked quite a bit. He talked about himself a lot, and anytime that I tried to interject, he would interrupt and start back talking about himself.
I don't remember that.
So the night finally ended, he actually had told me, you know, he had a really good time and he was hoping to go out again. And he walked me to the door and then he left. He called me up after that. I guess once he got home, he had called me and he wanted to call to just reiterate the same thing. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to tell the truth. And I had told him that I was really kind of turned off by just our conversation and certain things that he said, blah, 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 blah. But what really hook, line, sunk me
was, say it, baby, tell me.
Was he had told me that he had never been out with a woman of my caliber before. And he's only, you know, dated girls or gone out with girls. And so he was really really nervous just about the date. And that if I...
That was smooth, Mike. That was smooth, brother. That was smooth.
And that if I, you know, gave him another chance, that he, you know, would make sure that I'd have, you know, a good time. So I was like floored, like the fact that he didn't make excuses or, you know, and rightfully so, like, you know, I had some pretty high expectations at that time. But he apologized and he was willing to make adjustments. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's so attractive. Like, that's really attractive. So we went out for a second date and we had a fabulous time.
Yep.
All this history now at that point.
That's right.
Okay. That's right. I love it. I love it. So oh man, that's awesome. So what do you all do for a living?
So I'm a high school teacher. I teach world geography. Mm-hmm. And I coached for about 10 years. So I stepped back from that about 3 years ago to focus more on really ministry and the family. Kids getting older. We have a 15-year-old son, 14-year-old daughter, and a 7-year-old son, which we'll probably talk about a little bit tonight with him. Would have been autism awareness. And so, of course, you know, involved heavily in ministry. But as far as my, I don't like to say secular, but for my, I guess my job on earth, besides ministry, is teaching. I've been doing that for about 15, 16 years. So I've been doing that for a while.
Mm-hmm. And I am a licensed professional counselor, also known as a mental health therapist or psychotherapist. And I've been doing that since 2006 and have seen wide ranges of individuals from working with adults in addiction when I first started out, who were duly diagnosed with, you know, like depression or anxiety. And then they also had some form of alcohol addiction or drug addiction, and transitioned from that and started working as a supervisor over a set of caseworkers. I saw clients who did case management services with them, who were also dealing with some type of maybe mood disorder. And then to transitioning to where I'm at today, providing individual therapy to a wide range of adults, older adults, teenagers. And this actually, when I started the job that I'm working at now, about 6 years ago, I'd say, my first encounter working with children. And so kind of diving deeper into dealing with kids who had behavioral problems or diagnosed with ADHD or anxiety or depression in conjunction with still working with adults and teenagers. So it's been a journey. It's been a really cool journey for me.
Wow. So you all sound like you are super busy people.
Yes.
It's an understatement.
Yes. But you all do it with such grace because, I mean, all that you do, you still are able to serve the Lord well. And I just want to give you all a shout out and acknowledge how I have the privilege of being able to watch you all serve in ministry, and the privilege of being able to just see how you handle all of the different, I guess I would say, the things that you all are juggling in your life. So I just want you to know that I think it's beautiful and the grace in which you all operate.
Thank you.
And yeah. And in fact, what Your Life Beyond You podcast is all about is painting this picture about the fact that we live this life here on earth, that we know that it's temporary. And so often people are so caught up in their lives, so caught up in what they're trying to do, that they forget that it's not about them. It's not about just your family, but there's just so much more that God wants to do. So I always like to ask this question, Mike and Marcia, and the question is, how do you use your secular platform where you work, where you live, how do you use that to actually share the love of Jesus?
I know me personally, just teaching and coaching for so many years. I look at it as just another pulpit or another sphere of influence. So even though on paper it says Mr. Crutchfield, word geography teacher, and you know, I'm certified and I have a degree in business as well. I just look at it as just a doorway to walk through, to be an example. And it's not necessarily me in the classroom, you know, open up the Bible and teaching these teenagers, but I think it's just about being an example, having conversations with them, building those relationships. And then once I build that relationship, I try to take opportunities to tell them about God. I mean, I open the Bible, but at some point the conversation will lean towards God. And I just think in any secular job, like any job that God has blessed us with is for a reason. And so I think sometimes we focus on thinking, okay, ministry is just me, a pastor, a missionary, or evangelist, or you know, whatever those titles are. We think, okay, that's set apart. But then when you go to work in the secular world, that's not ministry. And so I just understood early that this is part of ministry. Like this, every year of my life is part of ministry. Me being a husband, you know, me being a father, me working at the school, I'm still ministering. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just in a different setting. Mm-hmm. And though I may not be able to use the tools I can if I'm up in the pulpit, or if I'm talking to my children, or even to another fellow believer, I can still minister. And I think so many times as believers, we separate it. You know, it's like, well, I'm a dad, I'm a father, I'm this, but I'm actually all of those as part of the ministry God has given us. And so that's how I look at it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's good. I think for me, just the essence of what I do, which is, you know, helping people who are hurting to walk through a process of healing. You know, to me, that is the epitome of love, God's love. And so I, you know, take it as here's just this wonderful gift that God has given me to be able to help broken people find life or find restoration. And, you know, sometimes it's just practical tools and, you know, helping people to just kind of get back on their feet if they're, you know, dealing with some kind of crisis in their life, or if they're, you know, dealing with grief, as well as just doing, you know, therapy in a sense of building a therapeutic relationship, like actively listening and, you know, letting the person know, I understand where you're coming from, and, you know, that I'm here for you. And that in itself can be, you know, very, very therapeutic and healing, you know, for an individual. And those, of course, that it's kind of tricky. It's kind of like what Mike was talking about. In therapy, you can't necessarily force your personal views on the client. So it's really all about understanding where the client is at and kind of, you know, meeting them where they are. And so we'll have a discussion. Especially if they use certain keywords, like, you know, they maybe attend church, or, you know, they may say something related to God. It's like, I'll jump on that and I'll ask questions just about their spirituality, their faith walk, and what do they believe? And that always opens up the door to just implement, you know, biblical principles and godly principles, you know, for those who are believers. And then, you know, those who are not, still showing them the love of God and still being who I am, you know, that, which is like Mike saying, I can't separate, you know, me being a child of God and loving God. It comes out, you know, in our therapy sessions, but doing a lot of praying for them. So lots of praying. And God has really taught me how effective prayer is. You know, when I do that, even for my patients, that sometimes I may not ever have a conversation about God or talking to them about those that are unbelievers about salvation and leading them in the salvation prayer. But there have been a couple of times vividly to clients that I know specifically of that I just prayed for. Mm-hmm. And they told me how they ended up in a church and got saved, you know, had that opportunity to get saved. So, I had lots of praying, you know, for them, not only just those that are unbelievers in their salvation, but just even, you know, even those that are part of the body of Christ that are, you know, seeking out therapy, that are having tough times, you know, just asking God to intervene on behalf of their situation too. And that's always really been effective.
Wow. I think that is so beautiful, Marsha. I'm so glad you shared that, because, you know, maybe you aren't able to say anything to them. Maybe they would become offended. But one thing they can't stop you from doing is they can't stop you from praying for them. Right. You know, because they may not even be aware that you're praying for them. But wow, that is so, so beautiful. And I'm so thankful that you shared that. There seems to be, especially in the African-American church, in the context of the African-American community, this idea that, OK, I don't need therapy. You know, it's almost like people see therapy or Jesus.
Yeah.
Why do you suppose that's the case?
I think culturally, I think just because of our past history. And you got to think about ever since from slavery, you know, to now, and it had slavery, coming out of slavery and segregation and just what our parents, their parents, kind of like our ancestors dealt with. It was almost like they was living life in survival mode. Mm-hmm. And so every day was a day of just trying to survive. And so you really didn't have time to really give into your emotions. You didn't have time to give into being discouraged or these different emotions. Right. And so it was just about survival. And so you had this pendulum where a lot of the, you know, the slaves and so forth leaned on God, and it was Jesus. So which is great. You know, we held on to the spiritual hope that, you know, that we'll be free. You know, mm-hmm. I think the short side, there's no short side to lean on Jesus. Don't misunderstand me. But I think what happens is it was embedded in each generation. It's about you don't have time to cry. You don't have time to feel sorry for yourself. Mm-hmm. It's about we got to get up and we got to survive. We have to live. You live like trying to fight for your life every day. And I don't mean like always physically, but just the mentality. Mm-hmm. And so really there was no room to it was almost like it was like dehumanizing. And there was no room to really be a human, because if you're not treated like a human, how you know how to act like a human? And part of being human is we have emotions, right? We have joy and pain, and we have suffering. We have laughter and crying, and we have discouragement, and we have, you know, discomfort. Mm-hmm. So now I think that has been so etched within our culture. Now you look at if someone says, man, I'm feeling down or depressed, we look at it as a sign of weakness. Mm-hmm. Depressed, then you're not gonna be able to survive. So suppress those feelings, right, and just live, survive, exist. And so I think what a lot of people from my generation, you know, you start hearing about mental health and about, you know, therapy and having somebody to talk to, that sounded very foreign. Mm-hmm. To the point to where if I talk to someone, if I go get therapy, that means I'm not putting my faith in Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And so in reality is it's you see it all through scriptures when James said, confess your sins one to another, you might be healed. That's like having a conversation.
That's right.
That's like telling someone, you know, what are you dealing with? Mm-hmm. What are you struggling with? You get what I'm saying? Because anything that we put above God is actually a sin. So if I put depression above God and I keep making it my Lord, then I need to go talk to somebody about that. You know, and healing takes place, you know, so it's like ultimately God heals us, but it takes somebody else with us to help us walk out that healing. And I think just within our culture, we were robbed of many years. And so now it's like now that we're free in air quotes, you know, now how do we learn how really to be human? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's really that's just my observation, I believe, is one struggles within our African-American community.
I was just going to add to, and then I do think also, along with what Mike is saying, that there was a bit of a survival mode that we, you know, were living in, And the outlet that we did have was the was the church. Mm-hmm. You know, so the pastor became, you know, the go-to person to talk about, you know, different struggles that are, you know, that they were dealing with in the family with, you know, and, you know, it was heavily focused on supporting through prayer, you know, and scripture, which is good, which is absolutely needed. Then I think it became more of, you know, I can only talk to my pastor. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't talk to anybody else about this. And I used to work in the Fifth Ward area, which is really interesting when I first started out this agency that I'm with currently now. And so it was really interesting to have to deal with those kind of dynamics when I was first meeting with a client that was African-American from the community that was coming in for therapy because they were dealing with depression, you know, and you're having to really the first few sessions, it's just kind of exploring some of those stigmas and that, you know, I only go to my pastor about these things. Mm-hmm. I rely on my pastor, the church, you know, to help me through these things, to pray with me. But I don't really take that outside of anybody else or, you know, I keep it within my family, but I don't talk about it to anyone else. And I think there's, you know, just the, like how Mike was saying that there's a lack of faith or that it's all, you know, demonically driven or, you know, has to do with, you know, all, you know, ultimate spiritual undertones, you know, and things like that. And so I think as we just kind of become more open to realizing that God sees us as a whole person, and that he recognizes that, yes, we're, you know, we're spiritual beings once we are renewed in him, but we also still have a body that we live in and we still have an emotional state and we still have a mental state that affects us. And, you know, all of those things have, you know, are important to address and that it's okay, you know, to seek out someone who is outside of the church that can be trusted, you know, to help walk through with an individual who's just trained to provide clarity and understanding and direction, you know, so that person can experience, you know, wholeness. Because a lot of times what we're dealing with emotionally, it affects us spiritually, you know, even sometimes what we're dealing with physically, you know, certain physical ailments that we have or illnesses that we have, it affects us spiritually too. You know, we're so intertwined with all of those things. And so, you know, God desires to bring about wholeness and health. He says, I desire that you prosper and be in health even as your soul prospers. He recognizes that that's important, that our soul prosper, that our emotional state to be healthy, that our mental state to be healthy, just as well as our spiritual state.
Amen. That's a good word. I'm glad you brought that up, Marsha, and really shared that. And so I can totally see how you all both are able to take your secular job and the Lord can still work through you and really, really minister to people who may never enter into a faith community or what some people may refer to as a church. But, you know, I don't want to get on a soapbox, but we know that the church is not a facility, but it's a community. And so many people may never venture into a community where they can be ministered to. And so what a blessing it is to be able to use your life to enhance the lives of other people. So I think that is so, so beautiful. And thank you all so much for sharing that. Now, today we are focusing in on autism awareness and acceptance because, as we know, April is Autism Awareness Month. And I'd like to give you all an opportunity to share your experience when it comes to autism.
Well, I guess we can just start off by just talking about our son, Micah, who is our 7-year-old. He's our youngest. Just our journey with him discovering that he had autism and going through the process of, you know, having him see a professional and receiving that diagnosis and implementing different forms of like treatment to be able to help him. So when Micah, well, he, I had a normal pregnancy. I had him when I was at age 30. I conceived at age 34 and I had him when I turned 35, a month after I turned 35. Had a normal delivery, had a normal pregnancy. No, you know, as far as like health conditions or health issues. He came out healthy. He was a healthy baby boy. I believe he was about 7 pounds and 10 ounces, 21 inches. So, healthy baby boy, and, you know, easily, breathed on his own and was able to, you know, drink from a bottle, in the hospital when, you know, of course, when, you know, they just have to monitor him and things like that. And so, he seemed to be developing pretty normally, as far as, you know, from birth all the way up until about 12 months. And, we went to regular checkups with the doctor, and he came out, you know, normal. There was no red flags or anything like that, that the doctor, you know, had noticed. And so, when he reached about 2 years old, and mind you, he walked, I did notice that it took him a little bit longer to walk compared to my other children. He started walking about 14 months. And, I just kind of thought, well, maybe this is because he's the baby. And, he was actually being taken care of by, Mike's mom and dad. So I didn't have to put him in daycare when he was born. They, matter of fact, they watched him all the way up until he was from birth to age two, when I had to return back to work, or 2 months after he was born and I went back to work, they watched him. So I thought, well, maybe it's just because, you know, there's no other kids around and, you know, there's not a whole lot of activity, you know, that maybe he's engaged in. And so maybe that's why he's not walking. So I didn't really think too much of it. He was still, as far as like language developing, he was, you know, saying certain words, and seeming to be fine. When I actually put him into daycare, he was age two. He did okay. He seemed to be, again, flourishing pretty well. But got time for him to transition from out of the 2-year-old to the 3-year-old classroom. That's when I started noticing some things where in the new classroom he had transitioned to, he didn't really talk much. He wasn't talking as fluently as the other kids were. And it was almost as if he was developing normally. And then for some reason he started to regress, like the older he got. So it was, it really kind of caught us off guard a little bit. So, one of the daycare workers mentioned, hey, you know, he's not really talking much in class. He doesn't say too much. He just, you know, sometimes he cries and he acts pretty anxious, you know, now that he's in this new classroom. Have you ever thought about maybe seeing if he needed speech therapy? And so I was like, okay, you know what? That's, yeah, I can definitely look into that. And the speech therapist came to the house and, was interviewing us and asking, you know, Micah some questions and observing him. And she noticed that his language was pretty delayed. Yeah. And she suggested that he be assessed to see possibly if he has autism. And so we eventually, so which was really cool is, I really felt like God had already started to prepare Mike and I both about in dealing with a kid who was going to be on the spectrum. So when I mentioned about me starting this job that I currently working at about 6 years ago, I had never worked with kids. This is my first time. And I remember vividly the very first week that I started, I had my first autism kid. So it was like a learning experience for me. And so I hands-on had to figure out how to do therapy with an autistic kid who didn't speak. And it was interesting because the mom brought him in because he, for behavioral reasons, but she didn't know at that time. And so my first encounter with a kid who had not been diagnosed was me also walking through that process with mom and discovering, hey, I do think he has autism. And, you know, going through the diagnosis and assessing it and whatnot. So, I had already a year before Michael was born was starting. I feel like God was starting to prepare me for that. And I know, Mike, you can probably mention
that. Yeah, I know. Definitely. Just even me teaching, I think around the time when he was, after he was born, the content I was teaching was phasing out. So I got switched to world geography, mm-hmm. but I got switched to teaching spec ed. And so I had never taught spec ed in all my years of teaching. And so now I'm in the classroom, you know, general and spec, they're, you know, integrated. But I'm learning about 504 plans. I'm learning about called BIPs and like all these, doing R's, all the stuff that I'm, now it's like I'm getting introduced to. And as Marsha was saying, not really realizing that God was actually preparing us, mm-hmm. equipping us, you know, to meet the needs mm-hmm. of our own
self. Right.
And so, yeah, so I know my end with my career, I just saw a shift and me being introduced to things I wasn't even aware of. Mm-hmm. And so me becoming more sensitive, sitting on the R's and, you know, teaching kids who have autism, you know, high on the spectrum, low on the spectrum, just different variants of kids, mm-hmm. Kids with speech delays. So these things, so I'm already getting introduced to this, not knowing, you know, it was preparation, mm-hmm. you know, for Micah.
Yeah.
So.
And by the time you know, the speech therapist had made a recommendation for him to be assessed, I immediately knew what to do because I, again, had worked with kids who were school age and kids who, you know, were 3 years old or 4 years old before they'd actually enter into school, that if they do have a form of disability, how they can get help, you know? And so I knew about, you know, the, school district that we're zoned to provide assessments for kids who are younger than school age children, you know, so between the ages of 3 and 5, that they could assess for free. And could actually, you know, kids could actually start to receive speech therapy services through the school district and occupational therapy if it's needed through the school district, as well as begin to start early childhood education to kind of help them prepare for, like, when they do enter into school and, you know, as far as in kindergarten. So it was actually a blessing that we were able to get him tested through the school district, and it was for free. And when he got assessed, they definitely said, yeah, we do think he has autism and we think that he has a speech delay problem, and also that he probably could benefit from occupational therapy, which is to kind of help with his fine motor skills mm-hmm. and his gross motor skills. And so I was able to get all of the help that I needed through the school district. And wow. it was a really big blessing because at this time he had trouble in, right, like 3 different daycares. So we had to take him out of daycare, try to put him in another daycare. And he was having some behavioral problems, you know, mm-hmm. lots of crying and not wanting to follow directions. And
so can I jump in here really quick and ask a question?
Sure.
Yeah. So is it possible that some parents that are having behavioral problems with their children, that it actually could be something else and not just that they're being ornery?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I mean, I believe so, but I think it goes back again to the culture, how we think.
Mm-hmm.
And with the idea of, well, you know, this child is being rebellious and we're just going to lock down on discipline. And anybody knows me, I'm pro discipline. You know, I'm pro correct. I'm pro, you will be held accountable, you know, but if you don't understand the language of how that child's trying to communicate,
mm-hmm.
then you can't really hold them accountable effectively because they don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where we had to, I know myself, just understanding, okay, I can't discipline Micah the way I discipline his 2 older siblings.
Right.
It's not that he can't be disciplined. It's not that he can't be held accountable, but there's just, I have to understand the way, how does he communicate?
Mm-hmm.
Because if I can understand how he communicates, then when I do discipline or I do try to check those behaviors, then if I don't understand him, he don't understand me, then it's all for naught. And it actually can lead to discouragement.
Right.
discouraging him and just killing his confidence, you know, because he's dependent on his mother and I to, like, we the essence of life to him, you know. And so that's why it's very careful, you know, important to understand that. And so, yeah, that's a good question.
Wow, that's big, man. So maybe there are some listeners right now that have no clue of what autism really is. I do have a working definition for autism, and I guess you all can share maybe your experience of how you've seen that play out. But I have that autism is also known as autism spectrum disorder, and it refers to a broad range of conditions characterized by challenges with social skills, repetitive behavior, speech, and nonverbal communication. Yeah. And, you know, I think so. When should a person, or what should a person look for if they think that maybe their child or grandchild or a family member or friend's child should be tested? What should they be looking for?
So just to kind of capitalize on those three things that you mentioned about autism spectrum disorder, that it is difficulties with communicating, certain repetitive behaviors, and having trouble with interacting with others. And so the spectrum is very wide, but there's a common thread. There's a common thread even in the differences on the spectrum, that they, kids with autism, lack social skills, and ability to communicate, and have repetitive or kind of awkward behaviors. So when you think about the social skills, some of the things to look for is, you know, by the age of 12 months old, not responding to their name when they're being called, not having any interest in like playing or sharing or talking with other people, not attempting to, you know, initiate a conversation, even at, you know, 12 months old, or initiate some kind of an interaction, you know, for it to be alone, even avoiding or like rejecting any kind of physical contact, especially like if they're upset about something. Sometimes kids on the spectrum, they don't like to be comforted. And then they might have problems maintaining eye contact. So even when maybe you're directly speaking to them, they're not giving eye contact. And then they might even not really understand other people's emotions, nor really know how to express their own. So those are kind of like some social skills that, you know, to be looking out for. And as far as like communication, about 40% of kids actually that are on the spectrum don't talk at all.
Wow.
And there's 25 to 30% that develop language skills during infancy, but then they lose them later. So that's what Mike and I had experienced, that Mike seemed to be developing normally. He would say one or two words here and there, you know, mama, dada. And then it's like he just stopped talking and he stopped developing his word, you know, his vocabulary. And so they might begin to develop language, but then they can start to lose it. And by two years old, you would start to notice like there's a significance in a lack of growth, you know, in their vocabulary. They might even have a flat and robotic speaking voice, or like a sing-song voice. So, you know, when they talk, it sounds, you know, again, very robotic. It sounds, you know, very like they're singing a song. And then sometimes they might even repeat phrases over and over again. So those are just some things, if they're younger or if they're older, that might be noticed. And then they also, when it comes to patterns of behavior, they might act in ways that are kind of unusual or have interests that aren't really typical. They might have repetitive body movements, like, you know, hand flapping or rocking or jumping or twirling. It might even, you know, constantly be moving or pacing or appearing to have kind of like hyper behavior.
I see. Yeah.
I was just going to say one that's really common is they they have a specific routine or ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever the routine is broken up by something different, or you do something out of sorts, they can get, that can really get them upset or kind of throw them off.
Right. Okay. Yes, that makes a lot of sense. So something that I'm curious about is, or really I'm more so fascinated how it is listed as a spectrum, because you can have kids on one end of the spectrum where they go on to live normal, unassisted lives in a sense. And then you have all the way on the other end of the spectrum where children never grow to independence. Mm-hmm. And just, so is that the result? Could it be a result of the lack of early detection, or how does that work? Is that important, early detection?
I would say it. I think early detection is important, because now you can identify if, like, Michael would be considered high functioning.
Mm-hmm.
So you have that spectrum where those are people who get detected early, and you give them everything that they need early. Mm-hmm. That you create that environment for them, so when they become adults, they have the you know, the chance to really live on their own. Mm-hmm. You know, because you caught it early. But then those who are on the other spectrum, it's obvious. Mm-hmm. So I think what happens is those on the other spectrum, you see it from me. It's obvious.
Yeah.
And I think those who are in danger are the ones who are the high functioning. They're on the other end.
Okay.
Because they lack of better words, you know, they don't appear that something's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the things that are wrong, they're so subtle, we may assume is that, oh, you know, he's just taking his time to develop, or, mm-hmm. you know, don't rush them, you know, let everybody develop at their own pace. And so those are the ones who really, I think, get overlooked, because you can't see it from just the naked eye.
Mm-hmm.
It takes observation. And so, yeah, that's how I would look at that. You can chime in.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. Early intervention is going to be helpful. There's no cure. So, you know, there's nothing that, as far as medication that could be taken, or, you know, some form of treatment that can cure it. And so it is about teaching the child at an early age how to cope,
mm-hmm.
and how to assimilate to his or her environment. Because really autism, you know, there's a saying, if you know one person with autism, you know one person with autism. Because it is such a wide spectrum, and everybody's just so, you know, unique. And so
interesting. Mm-hmm.
It's really important to be able to get early intervention so that you can tailor treatment according to what that child needs. Mm-hmm. Because it's, you know, not every treatment is going to be the same,
mm-hmm.
You know, for each one. So, you know, once a parent does start noticing some things, you know, definitely just having that child to be assessed to see if there is a possibility that, you know, their child might be on the spectrum, and then formulating some form of treatment, whether that's, you know, through the help of school, if you're school age kids, mm-hmm. or even if they are even younger than that, to help prepare them, you know, to be able to cope with some of the things that they're dealing with. And even I've seen other kids who have been in middle school, mm-hmm. that have gotten diagnosed for the first time.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like Mike was saying, you know, certain things just flew under the radar that wasn't caught. Or if there were some things that were noticeable, you know, nothing was really done about it, you know, for whatever reason. And so, you know, those individuals have a little bit of a harder time adjusting, because they've kind of attempted to try to figure out how to assimilate in their own world the best way they know how. And so sometimes maladaptive behaviors can be established, and kind of ineffective ways of coping, you know, can be established. And so if you can catch it early, that's always going to be a lot more helpful than just tailoring treatment. That's going to be able to help them to just be able to have, for the most part, you know,
a quality of life.
Yeah.
Wow. I love it. So from a support standpoint, what ways can society, like schools or faith communities, extended family and whatnot, support children and adults who are autistic?
I think, honestly, I think schools, I can't speak for all schools, but I think for the most part,
mm-hmm.
I really like schools and other, I guess, secular institutes have done a great, are doing a great job in providing what's needed. I think the faith community, the church, I don't generalize, I think that's where we're kind of falling short.
Yes. Okay.
And the reason why I say that is because the idea of how we define faith. And what I mean by that is, you know, we found out Micah had, you know, was diagnosed with autism. I think, honestly, I mean, it was hard to accept.
Right.
You know, it does hit you. And I think it hit us because of the way we look at life, our view of what perfection and what normal looks like. And if something looks different to what we predetermined was normal, then it's hard for us to accept that. And so, and then you'll think about your child, like, I don't want my child to have to go through life like this.
Right.
And so you have that feeling of disappointment, not in your child, because you love, you know, we love our child. Of course. You know, we're just like, man, you know, I wasn't expecting this. And I think you move from there. When I talk about faith, those moments where, you know, I pray, you know, God, because I believe God at any day, any moment, if he wanted to, Micah could wake up the next morning and no longer have autism. That's just the kind of God that I serve, you know, but knowing that God had already prepared us.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Which already lets me know that he is not going to remove autism from him. And so now my faith shifts from, not that I don't believe God can't remove it. My faith has shifted towards, man, I have faith that God has equipped us and given us wisdom on how to parent him.
Yes.
And how to love him. And that's still faith.
It is. Absolutely.
And so it's not that because of I say my son have autism. That's not that. Don't say that. Don't claim it. No, my son has autism. And what really encourages me, I got up on my screen, is Psalms 149, 13 says, you made all the delicate inner parts of my body.
Yes.
It fit me together in my mother's womb. Thank you for making me so wonderfully complex. Your workmanship is marvelous. How well I know it. You watched me as I was being formed in utter seclusion, as I was woven together in the dark of the womb. You saw me before I was born, and every day of my life was recorded in your book. Every moment was laid out before a single day had passed. So when I look at Micah, I look at Micah through the lens of the scriptures, that he's beautifully, wonderfully made before the eyes of God. His workmanship is marvelous.
Yes.
And so who am I to say that maybe Micah looks at life through a different set of lens that maybe I wish I could look at? Yeah. Maybe there's things he see in life that because of autism allows him to see that I can't even see. And maybe I would long to see that. And so as far as the church, as the faith community, I think we have to have a healthy balance of just acknowledging that if someone in the faith who has a child who's born with mental disability, however they want to word it, that sometimes it's that God created that child. And God and Marsha and I, we look at it like this, that it's a privilege that we feel honored for God to give us Micah.
Amen. Yes, because, sir.
Like, he has trusted us to parent him. You know, he could have gave Micah to anybody else. And so he gave him to us, and God had been preparing us from beginning of time to be Micah's parents. And so I didn't get an education just to be an education, you know. Marsha just didn't get in therapy to get in. There was still God's plan. You know, so just as the faith community, you know, I think we need to do a better job of knowing when there's things in life that we encounter, that God's will be done. And if part of his will was Micah to be born with autism and for us to be his parents, then I'm going to put faith in that. And, you know, we've had, you know, some people, you know, kind of maybe question, man, y'all really didn't have faith, you know, y'all didn't believe, you know, if you would have really believed, then God would have healed him. And it's like,
wow.
Part of it's kind of like, you know, how dare you?
How dare you? Absolutely.
That's with anybody. And to me, I believe we're walking more in faith and parenting him, giving the stuff that he needs. To me, that shows God that we're going to steward this child well.
Amen.
You know, we're not going to be the guy with the one talent and just don't parent our son and just spend all time. We're just going to wait for healing and don't give him the things that he needs, that we don't, you know, give him the support that he needs.
Mm.
You know, we're going to be the one that was given a 2 and a 5 and be faithful servants.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just think as to the faith community, and I just want to encourage anybody in the community, in the church who has a child with any, I guess a birth handicap,
mm-hmm.
that still believe that God can heal.
Yeah.
I'm not saying don't believe that God can heal,
yeah.
but also leave room for God to decide not to heal.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe his healing is on the other side. Mm-hmm. And so that's just kind of my little battle cry to the faith community. It's just like, you know, have a healthy balance. So I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it does, man. Beautifully said. And I know that your wife had something she wanted to chime in because she so patiently waited.
Yeah, I think being more open-minded as far as educating, being more educated about just the different disabilities. And, you know, of course, even just dealing with mental health, being more open-minded about educating. I think that the faith community can do better with just educating itself on different aspects of mental health and being more open-minded with encouraging people to, you know, to seek out help. If something is noticed, you know, obviously to rely on the church community for support, you know, through mm-hmm. prayer and encouragement and reflection of scripture, you know, and just, but also, you know, just not shunning anybody who might be dealing with some form of mental health, or excluding them or, but still loving them and loving their family. And even, you know, I think having a sense of, curiosity as far as just even wanting to know more about,
right.
you know, when there's a child, for example, that has autism, like it's okay to ask, it's okay to be intrigued. It's okay to, you know, to want to know more,
right.
You know, rather than noticing differences about that child or about this person that might be dealing with mental health. But not really saying anything, you know, but, you know, it's okay to ask and it's okay to, you know, to inquire, you know, in a respectful, healthy way. But, you know, just, you know, making families, I think, feel welcome and yeah. individuals feel welcome.
Mm. So well said, Crutchfields. I am so thankful for you all's transparency and just willingness to speak candidly about your experiences and to share. Do you have any last thoughts for anyone who may be at a point where maybe it's not autism that their child or loved one is dealing with? Maybe it's some other mental illness or some other type of challenge that they are faced with. Mm-hmm. You all seem to have been able to do this with such grace. Do you have any words of encouragement or wisdom?
I would say definitely, you know, seek out help. Maybe talk to, you know, if there's certain things that anybody's noticing about themselves or about their family members, you know, seeking out help, starting just with the doctor, mm-hmm. you know, the pediatrician or, you know, our PCP doctor is usually the first line of defense to talk to about, you know, anything that a person might be dealing with, whether that's, you know, maybe depression or anxiety, and just talking with them about that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, you know, seeking out therapy, you know, mm-hmm. and I'll even say, you know, you can't gain wisdom and direction from just anyone. So even someone who is a therapist who is, you know, someone of the faith, seeking out somebody to talk to about different things that they might be dealing with. You know, it's something that I would encourage them to.
Wonderful. Well, Crutchfields, you all have truly brought value and enlightenment for me as we just really have talked through just a range of things. And I think for me, one of the big takeaways that I loved that you all mentioned earlier is the fact that we can share our faith in so many different ways, and that we don't have to separate it when it comes to our various roles in life, whether we are in our families, our role in our families, or our role on our jobs, or even in our community, that who we are that everywhere we go. So, right. Yeah.
And I say this real quick.
Sure.
I was telling Marsha earlier.
Absolutely.
Just as encouragement, but also just the reality that we live in a fallen world. Mm-hmm. And it's just the state that we live in. And so none of us are immune to being affected by the this fallen world. Mm-hmm. And just understanding that this is not our home as believers. And whatever we're dealing with here, you know, that this is just temporary.
Yes.
And so if you may feel like, you know what, you may deal with depression to the day that you go see the sun. Hmm. But the promise is that that'll pass away. Mm-hmm. You know, my son, unless God decides to remove it, he's going to be autistic for the rest of his life. You know, there's things in life that we all struggle with. Mm-hmm. It may be there. But the hope is knowing that this is temporary. And so I think always giving people hope that's in that state. This is temporary. Mm-hmm. This is temporary. You know, and I think sometimes we forget that.
Well said, brother. And that's definitely encouraging for me. There's a statement that I don't want to start preaching here because, you know, we about to, you know, but I have discovered that when suffering is consistent and it's not something that goes away, it causes us to look for the eternal. It causes us to have hope in what is to come. And that is the sentiment that I'm hearing you share, Mike, is that, hey, at the end of the day, this is a temporary place and we want to be intentional to prepare intelligently for eternity and have hope in that. Well, Crutchfields, thank you all so much for investing time today to share your thoughts and just your heart on just some of the things that we've covered today, especially our discussion on autism. So truly thank you all for being on the show today.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Us. We appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
I know that you enjoyed today's podcast. A special thanks to the friends and partners of Growing Faith. You helped to make this possible. Now, our prayer is that our lives would be so filled that it spills over into the lives of others. You have been listening to Your Life Beyond You.